He has had all this. He has done all these things. But nothing is solved. He's not where he was before, except perhaps a little dazed by his own achievement. His cosmic consciousness didn't solve anything. He cannot, even now, with all his cosmic consciousness, solve his personal life much better than he did before. All his enlightenment has been a vast, abstract illumination. He sees a little further into the cosmos than he ever did before, but no further into himself. Why? Because once more, the illumination and everything else is a beautiful dream. He wasn't illumined. He only thought he was. He dreamed he had cosmic consciousness and woke up and believed the dream. So along whatever is the actual hard core of this esoteric tradition is this strange world of fantasies. Fantasies which can lead you in one direction or another. Can cause one individual to believe that he has been cast into perdition and the other to believe that he has attained through samadhi union with the eternal Atman. And in fact, he's exactly where he was when he started in both cases. Frightened in one, splendidly rejoicing in the other, and with all his lore, a fool no wiser than before, as Faust tells us. So this whole thing has become a strange blind island. And how many people got caught in it, we hope to say, but there have been many. And the reason why they're all caught in it is because they have broken one of HCB's final and most basic rules. Namely, that in the process of growth, no human being can skip, for any reason, any necessary step in the development of character. Furthermore, he can't, by any spiritual means, avoid the tiniest fragment of his karma. Therefore, there is no way by which the individual, in a state of partial development, with his faculties half developed, his nature but partly unfolded, can suddenly, by a violent action of piety alone, legitimate or not legitimate, become something that he is not. The only way that he can believe that he can become something he is not is to let his mind free. So in the practice of the yogas, especially Raja Yoga, the disciple has a long course before him. If he wishes, if you actually achieve his end, he has the first of all great decisions to make. Decisions which he must legitimately stand by once he has made them. And I think that in the Northern School of Buddhism, which is the one, of course, that HPB undoubtedly favored from the Voice of the Silence, as we discussed it last week, that the final motive, the only motive, that must be underneath this entire search for life is the bodhisattva vow, or the obligation taken to self, in which the individual dedicates his quest to truth, for truth, to one and only, that he may achieve the greater good of all humanity. That he may find, through any training and discipline, the way to bring peace and enlightenment to all that lives. No other motive whatsoever. No escape from a bad marriage. No compensation for loneliness. No substitution for ignorance. No subtle desire to get to the higher grades and transcend the rest of the membership. No feeling desire whatever to become an aristocrat in the great hierarchy of the law. None of these things whatever. most any interest in finding out knowledge because we would like to know. Or to find out what it is in the invisible world because we're interested. No search for conscious development of extrasensory powers because until we develop them, we cannot believe in immortality. None of these things at all. They're all false beliefs. And they will all block the individual and throw him into this mental illusion. There is only one motive, that the true seeker may be of the greatest advantage to humanity. And at the end of the path is complete dedication to the service of those who are in one way or another ignorant, sick, or miserable. But it ends in ministry completely. Not a ministry in the sense that we call congregational ministry, but ministry in the willingness to live and to die, perhaps, as Albert Schweitzer did, somewhere in the heart of Africa, simply because the sick needed him, and for no other reason whatever. He came very close, whether he knew it or not, to fulfilling the benefactor obligation. For him, therefore, a prayer for knowledge might be quite magic. But prayer for knowledge in order that we can foreclose on our neighbor's real estate certainly is not. Yet our search for power in this world, spiritual power, is simply to supplement and augment material power. And this is not legitimate. So we start with Rajayoga and we start with the purification. And you begin by gradually transforming your own personal existence into a dedicated life. One of the most common things that happens in the study of yoga, for example, is that the disciple finds himself under a tyrant, finds himself completely dominated by another human being. And a human being who is so desperately aggravating. Because when you want to argue, the teacher is silent. When you want to be silent, the teacher talks. And when you want to do what you want to do, the teacher says no. And the teacher gives very careful consideration. Have you a quick temper? You can soak in it until you get over it. If you want to make the teacher mad, it is impossible. Quietly, silently, inevitably, the yogin throws the individual back on himself. If you want peace, you will find it. Until you want it that badly, you won't have it. And as long as any pride is in you, as long as you are too proud to admit your own mistakes, or too enlightened not to correct them, you're not going to be told what to do and when to do it. You're told that you are seeking for truth, that you are asking to be of service to mankind. And therefore, you will conquer yourself whether you like it or not. And if you don't, you go home. Well, that's a very pleasant, cheerful start, you know. It weeds out candidates very rapidly. This is very much what you get when you start in Zen. It is just about as uningratiating a system as you will ever find. It will never permit you to find a comfortable place to nurse your thoughts. Yet by virtue of the karmic law, The teacher cannot intimidate you. He cannot put the gun to your head and say, do right or. Every decision has to be made by the disciple. And until he is ready to make the decision, he will go on as he is. Too soon now, if he gradually, it may take 5 years to break that horse and get it into condition to be of any good to anyone. As the Tibetan wind horse, who has to be trained for 10 years before it can carry the pair of feet on its back. But whatever it may be, plainly, the disciple begins to let down. She has either departed or else she has begun to see the truth and see a little of the light in this thing. And he realizes that what has been done to him is a very proper thing. He has simply been allowed to be as he is and as he was until he gets over. And that all justification and all these things are meaningless. The true purpose is the individual finding his own peace of soul. And this peace of soul is not going to be interrupted by one tantrum after another. When he has achieved this peace within himself, the teacher begins to take a little greater interest in him. Now this time, 5-7 years at least have passed. But now, the iron is being tempered. Something is happening. Little by little, the disciple is becoming a self-integrating power. He has learned the first great lesson, that he must grow by his own conviction, his own integrity, and that until he does, he is going to suffer. And no power on earth has a right to try to stop him from suffering. He can be invited to stop. He can be told why he should not do what he's doing. But if he does not accept the instruction, there's no power that can force him to accept karma. And it will. So having quieted these things, having become humble inside, having really achieved this mystery that we have in Christian mysticism, in which the individual places himself completely in the law, not my will, but thine be done. So if there is no longer self-seeking, there is only truth-seeking. There is no longer a saying of what truth must be. There is only a quiet watchfulness, a vigil toward truth. The master, having seen these things accomplished, very often about this time, begins to plan for a little better future for this particular disciple. He sees that he's not easily discouraged. The first disciple in China that Bodhidharma, the great Zen master, the first disciple that came to him in China, Dharma refused to see. And finally the disciple, after many efforts, cut off his arm and sent it over, saying, if you will not see me, see my arm. And tomorrow you will get the other arm and I will come in that way, piece by piece. Dharma said, now you are ready. Because he knew he would do it. So this is the integrity factor, that nothing is any longer important except the dedication. The dedication to the attainment of light for the good of all that lives. This is the spirit. Now the disciple after 5 or 6 or 10 years is very likely to go fairly well in this. But then the master says, this is fine, but there's something else. You have lived here alone. You have been with me. You have been away from most of the temptations of life. Therefore, now, for 5 years, you are going back in the world.
or you're not going to see me at all. You're going to have no contact with me. You're going back and you're going to work and you're going to live and you're going to meet the responsibilities of life and you're going to keep the consciousness you now have. You're going to have temptations now to test the consciousness. It's one thing to have it quietly in the forest and another to maintain it under the pressure of the community, the city, the town, the responsibilities, the personal burdens of life. So the disciple goes and may never come back. It's too much. But if he does come back and comes back obviously victorious, then he has probably been 10 to 12 years with the master by that time. The master then may let him do a little meditating under a very careful supervision. Not too much. Because he cannot meditate beyond the degree of the security of his insight. But gradually, the master will say something to him in this way. You are now gaining inner strength. The fulfillment of personal desire will no longer touch you. Ambition will no longer touch you. Compromise will no longer touch you. Fear can no longer reach you. You have a complete and single dedication. A dedication which no temptation of the sensual perceptions of the body of the mind can touch. Therefore, now it may be possible that you can begin to work with the esoteric structure of your own physiology. You can work with it now because you have no expectation of what is going to happen, actually. You have no motive that is going to force hallucination on you. You have no interest now in being greater or wiser than anybody else. Therefore, wisdom can be entrusted to you. You have no intention ever to profit from it physically. Therefore, it may be available at this time. You have no pride. You have no intentions of forcing your will upon anything. You don't want to start a religion. You don't want to do anything now. All you want to do is to grow. Grow in usefulness. And because you have gradually eliminated every ulterior motive, you can no longer fashion an hallucination. You can no longer make a false yogi out of yourself. By this time, in all probability, the disciple will have gone as far as this teacher can take him. Because actually, the realms and zones of instruction are a great diagrammatic chakra-like mandala, a tremendous structure, a hierarchy, in which all the layers and levels and degrees of spiritual insight are represented by two persons scattered throughout the world. So having achieved this end, the teacher who is genuine will then arrange for the disciple to pass on to the next level. So the teacher who has been with is in the world, in the place where he is, always to act as a bearer. He is never going to carry anyone further. This is his dedication. That he is not going to seek the light himself. He is only going to open the door for others. And because he is not anxious to know, he is only anxious to help others to know, he is stirring up a great merit. And this will all come back to him in due time. But the time no man knoweth. So the disciple is passed on to another teacher who will give him the rudiments of Raja Yoga. Perfectly certain that the slightest instruction will be absolutely obeyed. There will be unquestioning allegiance. That no matter what happens, this person could never become angry. Because if you start these delicate courses of vibration moving, and you have a vibration that is moving with the rapidity of light,
and anger hits it. A very slow and sluggish rate of vibration, moving perhaps less than the rate of a pedestrian. These two forces striking each other create a terrific disruption. You cannot do it. The teacher will never permit the disciple to do it until the disciple is obviously able to maintain the meditational or contemplative inner life and that nothing can touch it. This is the thought that we have, of course, in the illumination of Buddha under the Bodhi tree of Bodhidaya. Here he is sitting. The hosts of illusion rise from the earth before him. Maya rises with all his hosts, tempting. And it's very interesting that in the old Buddhist writings we have an almost exact parallel between the temptation of Jesus and the temptation of Buddha. Satan says to Jesus, "Bow down before me, and I will give you the mountains and the cities of the plains." And Mara rising up from the underworld in the presence of the meditating Buddha says, "Acknowledge my authority, and I will make you king of the whole earth." The saints are entire, but the saints remain completely unmoved. And all the temptations, power, glory, gratification, renown, fame, honor, personal love, wealth, everything is tossed at the disciple. And if he weakens, if he is moved by these things, then he cannot go on to Rajayoga. For the reason that if he is so moved and is in the discipline, he will destroy himself, and this cannot be permitted. So step by step, his development is measured to his absolute self-mastery. And it is possible that by the time he has finished with the second teacher and perhaps gone on to the third or fourth, each one a little nearer to the core of knowledge, that he will have a true understanding of these powers. And the reason why he has the understanding, the reason why he has been given the knowledge of these things, is in order that he may become a self-conscious, God-conscious instrument for the redemption of mankind. He has to know certain things, or he cannot finally lead the disciple of healing fashion into the light which is necessary. Then it is true, as the Raja Yoga points out, that this mysterious fire mist is loosened in the Shashumanadi. But it rises through the central ventricle of the spinal cord, finally entering into the brain, agitating the root of Manas in the pituitary body and the root of Buddhi in the pineal gland. Yet there is a great physiological process by means of which man fulfills the mystery of his own redemption and perfection. This is not, however, as Buddha also points out, a release from any previous obligation. In the process of discipleship, every obligation must be met. And as Buddha pointed out at the time of the last sermon, as reported and recorded in the Mahaparinirvana Sutta, Buddha pointed out that almost on the day of his death, or his nirvana, he paid his last debt. And if he had not paid his last debt, he could not have gone on. So the individual cannot achieve the true samadhi until he has transcended every sort of imperfection in his own nature which might prevent it. But he may, by consecration, speed up the process of karma purge.
And in one of her papers, H.P. Blavatsky mentions this point. She brings out the simple situation that when the individual, even at the beginning, begins to feel a dedication within himself, feels drawn to try to live better, or to make some spiritual integrity in himself, he immediately stirs up karma. It's quite possible that if he'd remained a nice, indifferent, complacent character, his life is divided between the job and the television, then he would have had three or four bad moments in the course of life. It would have been rather tough and difficult, like the one when he went 2 years without a job. That was pretty rough. That almost got him. He lost nearly everything that he had. And another awfully tough spot was when his home broke up. And the third awfully bad spot was when the doctor told him that it wasn't going to last much longer. These were the big emergencies, and this individual has to face them. But the moment an individual assumes the voluntary effort to enlightenment, Luke says, well, in order to get you there, you're going to have to make the monthly payments a little higher and shorten the term a little. If you want to pay $50 a month on the house, you can do it for 40 years. But if you want to pay off in 10 years, you've got to make a bigger payment. That's the only answer to that. So what happened? Instead of having four or five difficult decisions which you must rise to meet, there are five defects of character that are going to rise to make him difficulties and troubles. He suddenly finds that everything goes wrong. 10, 15, 20 difficulties sitting in the course of a lifetime. Until he really feels pretty badly battered. Nature will send him too fast, however. Nature finds he's getting a little bruised, she slows up. But nature will feed them to him as fast as he is able to handle them. And he's going to have to use all of his integrity and all of his ability to handle them, not just a little fragment of it. He can't handle these now by just, you know, having a little chat with a friend about it over the back fence. These problems he has to face. He will never be faced with a problem he cannot solve, but he may be faced with a problem he is too mentally or emotionally lazy to solve. If he is, the progress slows down. His resolution and his intentions are not as strong as his tendencies to inertia. But if he does go on, he does to acquire, he will find that the life becomes increasingly difficult. And then, of course, the other side of the thing begins to also show through. With every conquest that he makes, with every achievement which he achieves instead of evading, there becomes available to him a new source of strength within himself. And this strength balances the pressure of the adversities. So while other people think he's having a terrible time, with each trouble, he is growing strong enough to handle the next one better. So it is not nearly as difficult as it looks at the beginning when the first avalanche hits. Gradually, skill increases. It's like a man playing chess. If you ever want to play a good game of chess, never play with anyone you can beat. It may be very consoling to find someone who plays worse than you do. It will never do anything to your good. I know one man who became a great chess expert, and he played for many years. And he said he played chess for nearly 4 years before he ever won a game. But as a result of that, he became one of the world's great players. He was constantly reaching for a better game, and not for one moment sitting back, to triumph over somebody who was a poor player. Same way the problems of living. The individual must never really expect to grow unless the problem is bigger than he is. But this is the way he gets there. And in getting there, he sometimes has to make some very strange and difficult decisions. He used to cling to principles that perhaps no one else will understand. He will have to keep true to conceptions and ideals that perhaps will bring in the bitterest condemnation, but he has to go on. Not only for his own sake, but because he would be doing the other person a terrible ill service if he gave the impression that that other person was right when he was doing wrong. All this adds up to the preparation of a psychochemical situation, as it came in the life of Buddha, as he pointed out to his disciples, to attain the nirvana, to pass to the other shore. The individual must have achieved victory over everything that belongs to the material world. The only answer is, of course, in the Bodhisattva doctrine, is one more step. He must also achieve victory over his own desire, his own hope, his own aspiration for release. At a time when he has finally discovered that the world can be only bondage, and he stands internally ready to leave it, having earned this right, if then he chooses bondage, he has made a still greater choice. He has chosen to fulfill the obligation of remaining the servant of mankind. This proves the end within him of the last bit of fragment of egoism. Now, one of the reasons why this is true is something that we don't realize, and that is that this mysterious path of the fire mist, this path of the Kundalini Shakti, doesn't just simply wind up the time. It winds down through hundreds of embodiments. The great process of growing up is only symbolized by the Raja Yoga discipline. The discipline itself begins in a remote past and goes into the infinite future. It's much more than even a lifetime with a guru. There is this other great problem of growing. Now we will say that the individual becoming an arhat, reaching a point where perhaps as a being, as an internal being, has achieved a tremendous victory. He knows inside himself, for example, that he has the right to come back, to be the servant of man. Now, of course, this could be a kind of a little bit of arrogance mixed up in this too, you see. After all, it's kind of nice to look forward to being a real savior, even though they've had a rough time of it. And, there's something that kind of is worldly about this too. But the doctrine reminds you of something else. When you come back, you are not going to know why you're here. You're not going to know if you're a world savior. When the Bodhisattva turns back to become the servant of mankind, he is reborn in some creature, some being, without the slightest remembrance that he's a Bodhisattva or any related to it. All he will have to work with, all this world savior has to work with, is the tremendous internal intuitive sense of duty. They don't have any remembrance of the fact that they really have a beautiful, comfortable place to sit on a lotus blossom somewhere else. No. When they take upon themselves, as the Bodhisattva Kanman is supposed to have done, embodiment, they may be embodied in an animal. And in that animal body, they will live and suffer and die exactly that animal, with no sense of any superior power. But as that animal, they will have something inside of themselves of a greater mercy, a greater patience, a greater self-sacrifice. And by this embodiment, this being is gaining, the Bodhisattva is gaining internally, in the only way that it can be done, the true insight into the nature of the animal. Burbank told me one day, he said, I'd give anything in the world if I could just be one of my plants for a moment, that I could have the experience of knowing the consciousness. Another scientist told me, he said, we could solve every mystery of the universe if for 5 minutes I could change places with my cat. Then I would know what consciousness is. And I cannot. I can never be anything but myself, a stubborn, stuffy little being, locked within a pattern of circumstances that is unbreakable. The better set the obligation is the only way it can be broken. That is the only way in which the servant, the dedicated one, can become aware of the need of life. It can be born into the plant. It can be born into the animal and the bird. It can be born into the great falcon and die with the arrow of the hunter. It can be born into any one of these creatures and suffer with these creatures and thereby gain the great compassion. But while it is so embodied, it is not a bodhisattva standing by. It is not a being saying, well, I'm now in this body, but of course I know I'm somebody else. There is no such knowledge. And the bodhisattva becomes the falcon. It lives and dies with no consciousness beyond the falcon. But after it has dropped the body, it suddenly knows what a falcon is. It knows what the golden carp is. It knows what the dragonfly is floating up on the surface of a pool. It knows what the animal is that is scourged and beaten by man. It takes these things, and these become part of the great compassion of the Kunanda Sakti. So there is no hope in the sense that the individual is suddenly making a kind of little summon for into a lower form of life. They are that form of life. There have been cases where these beings have entered into undeveloped primitive races and taken all the slurs and hurts and insults that are heaped upon primitive people. They never knew that they were different from the 100 people they were with. But one of them broke through and became a great scientist, the scientist of his own people. But he was born to bring something through them. And he lived and died and fought and struggled with life and suffered poverty and humiliation for his entire life in order to do this. And he never for one moment had any idea that behind him was some luminous purpose that he had selected for himself. All he knew was that there was a job, and his heart told him it had to be done. So the strength of the bodhisattva is in the heart doctrine. The arhat coming back into embodiment does not appear as an old gentleman in robes and a stone-shaped head leading us back. He does not have a magic horse in the beard or anything of that nature. All of these dedicated ones have no strength other than other people have, except one thing. In their heart is tremendous insight into the human soul and the great need of serving. That's the reason they're here. And no one knows who they were, and they do not know who they were. That's why the reward is very trivial. It again is a complete dedication and nothing else. And somewhere in this world, this dedication, the code of Vishuddha, this great dedication is the reason for life. This dedication makes the pure, mature person. This is the dignity and honor for which we were fashioned and why we were made just a little less than the angels. It is because of this power, this life, this skill, this tremendous privilege in ourselves. And it is in this way that the Kundali Shakti winds its way through our embodiments in its ascent to the great day of the Parinibbana. It is in this way also that our whole evolution is measured in this strange mystical caboose that follows the linking and interlinking of the cerebrospinal and autonomic nervous systems. Rindy Raja Yoga of the esoteric school. There are two sets of chakras. One according to the more tantric system, extending along the spinal cord, and the other set entirely in the brain. Actually, the great secrets of Raja Yoga belong to a set of ganglionated centers that are entirely within the brain. They do not extend down the cord. Those in the body below are the reflections of this. And just as the sun draws water from the earth, so the great centers in the brain draw the body currents up through the spine. But the great problem is truly one in the brain itself. And in every religion and philosophy of the world, we have this phenomenon discussed. We have told you many times of the Taoist concept of water, of rain. How the great cycle of Tao is likened to the water cycle. How the rain falls up in the mountains, and the mountains drain off into streams, and the streams become rivers, and the rivers return to the oceans, and the heat of the sun raises the water from the sea and drops it again on the mountains, and the great cycle goes on forever. This is also the Kundali Shakti cycle. This is the cycle of the mysterious dew of heaven described in the advanced mysteries of the Kabbalah. This is the great cycle of the light in the brain, the centers in the brain drawing up this power and circulating it through the body, circulating it downward to the great nervous system which has its root in the brain. For if the brain is watered, if the nervous system is watered, it must be watered in the brain, in what the Kabbalists call the cranial dew. This mysterious water that precipitates from the third ventricle. This is picked up by the nervous system, carried down through the body. It's picked up again by the sympathetic nervous system and carried up through the ganglionated mystery of the chakras, back again into the brain in an endless cycle. Now, the individual actually, as has been pointed out, he allows these processes to develop normally and naturally within himself. This is not even aware of it. The person who grows, unfolding according to the highest ethical, moral, spiritual conviction of his own nature, following step by step to the obedience of his own dedications, and gradually refining these dedications by the very law of evolution which unfolds and perfects them. This individual gradually releases his entire esoteric structure without even knowing it. The only thing that he knows is that little by little he gains this inner insight. Francis, or the Assis, St. Francis, never realized that Kundalini or anything else had to do with his visions. He never understood or realized why he felt the communion to preach to birds. These things he did not study as scientific processes. But he knew that something happened within himself, and he gave credit for it to the grace of God. But those who study the esoteric thing realize that in the case of St. Francis and all bona fide mystics, this cosmic consciousness, which is represented by the opening of the thousand petal lotus, is not by the grace of God, but by the labor of man himself. But it is the grace in his own soul that has opened these things. And when he is right, these processes happen naturally. When the time comes for a baby to be born, it is cast forth into life. It does not require a great process of meditation, concentration, and scientific and magical means to bring the child out. When its time has come, nothing can keep it in except deformity. Therefore, when the time comes for man to experience the mysteries of the psychic world, the esoteric part of himself, when he is right, it happens. And this is really the highest form of Raja Yoga, is to permit growth to react upon the internal subjective nervous system. So the main process is that what we used to call the sympathetic nervous system, now more commonly known as the autonomic, that this system of sympathetic nerves is exactly that. It is a sympathetic nervous system. It is a nervous system responding to the great sympathies of the soul and following along perfectly with them. So that the individual who needs more light because he deserves it and will use it well, suddenly finds that he has it. And he doesn't know that a strange nervous chemistry has occurred within his body. He does not realize this. All he realizes is that light has come to him. But what he could also realize with a little more thought is that his own psychonervous system is so constituted that it can give him this light. And the reason why it gives it to him is because of something he has done. And the reason why it is not given to someone else is because the other person has not done this thing. So our esoteric growth, as we understand it, it becomes a very natural procedure. And this is why I think Buddha did not believe in the practice of austerity. Did not believe in flagellation as great physical discomfort in the name of controlling the body. He did not believe in extreme austerity or of asceticism. He believed rather that the individual forgetting himself in the great sincere desire to make this a better world would find that his inner esoteric nature supports him as he needs it, giving him the strength, giving him the wisdom, giving him the psychic support. If he has to get the support first, then there's something wrong. He's forcing it. It's far wiser for him to accept the support when he needs it. And if he does this, he doesn't have to worry about the rest of it. As he grows, his own body will support his growth. There is no degree of spiritual attainment that he can attain that the body cannot ultimately adjust to, giving him what support is necessary. And when he reaches a degree of enlightenment in which the body can no longer serve its purpose, then the body, as a faithful servant, steps aside and lets the life go on. There is no problem here. The problem is kind of a strange spiritual ambition, which is not the best thing. So H.P.B., I think, summarizes these problems, that there is a great transcendental esotericism that very few know about. And most of those who claim to possess it do not have it. And most of the books that are written about it are just exactly that. They are about and about. But actually, from the standpoint of the study of the symbolism of it, the entire system of the locus and talus, the entire system of the chakras, and of all this mysterious group of esoteric matters, this is very interesting, that it is a symbolism. And if the individual can study it, he will learn. If he tries to practice it, he will get in trouble, almost certainly. Because actually all he needs to do about it is to gain this insight that the process exists, that it is tied to a merit system within his own consciousness, and that all he needs to learn from Raja Yoga is that as he becomes better, nature will provide him with better instruments of consciousness. As he in his service has greater needs to help others, he will never be left without the means of meeting these needs. And as many have discovered in smaller ways in this world, the best way to learn is to become a teacher. Because in a mysterious way, when you are trying to teach someone else, you will discover that you know more than you ever suspected that you knew. The need of the other person brings out of you a greater knowledge. And the great need of humanity when faced by the Arhat or the Mahatma makes this link to the superior processes by which learning is possible. And the individual discovers that there will always be behind his dedication to service the skill to serve well, the skill coming strangely from the secret sources of knowledge within himself. So for all general purposes, it seems to me that while Madame Blavatsky does build this understanding of the esoteric system, she points out constantly the danger of spiritual delusion, points out continuously the hazard that comes to the individual who tries to force growth above the achievements of character. And she has warned all of her disciples of the danger of this point. And the great safety lies always in this simple fact that these processes happen naturally when the disciple is ready. Therefore, our problem is to be ready and allow these processes to work in their own way. If we try to force them, if we try to realize that they represent some kind of magic, black or white, we are in considerable danger of getting into trouble. I think that is her final summary of this subject, and I guess this has to be our final summary of this series of discussions. So we hope that they will prove to be of some value to you. I'd like at this time to announce that our next Wednesday evening meeting will be on April 13th. And we're going to have a little series of three studies on parallels between Eastern and Western philosophy. And we're going to divide it into Eastern and Western Gnosticism, Eastern and Western Kabbalism, and Eastern and Western Alchemy, and parallel the systems, and try to see how each one contributes to the other. So our next meeting on Wednesday will be on April 13th. So this is your opportunity for a little vacation, and we hope you'll have a grand time until we get together again. Thank you very much.